Good morning. My name is Erin Glanville, if I haven't met you, lead pastor here at Artisan. Today, if you're visiting, you're here on the last of three sermons all in a row that are focusing on a question that we're holding, why church? As a way of trying to describe to ourselves why we're here still, why we still continue to be the church in this moment in history, in this cultural context. And we've named two already. One is the need for holistic healing, all kinds of holistic healing. And the second one is the need for community and a wider sense of belonging of all kinds, community of all kinds. And today we're talking about the need for imagination of all kinds. Each week we've looked at a story from Jesus' life to help us get into these things that we're seeking. And today, the story that we're looking at, that Carrie read for us earlier, is the story of Jesus' first speaking engagement right after the baptism and then his time in the wilderness. So after we look at that story, we're going to then talk a little bit about Artisan and our need for imagination. But we'll start first by just talking about imagination generally. Why do we need church? Why are we church? Why church? Because we need fresh imagination, and we need it to be grounded in the person of Jesus, and we need it to be energized by the Spirit, and we need other people to help us do it. That's the bottom line. So lots of words come to mind when I think of the word imagination. I think about creativity, beauty, play. I don't know what words. Anybody want to throw out a couple words that come to mind when you think of imagination? Dreams, nice. What's that? Wandering. Children. What's that? Adjust society. Yeah. Curiosity. Great. Yeah, we're all kind of in the same zone here, right, with imagination. Try this one on for size. What if imagination is using all of those things that we've just named, creativity, curiosity, play, dreaming, to create the possibility of freedom from broken paradigms? What if imagination is using all of these things to help us become free from broken paradigms? This week, I feel like every week, what I offer you in a sermon when I preach is just my collectings from the various people I've talked to through the week. Let's be honest. A lot of sermon prep is serendipity, what people talk about in a week and what kinds of conversations we have. And this week, Gustavo invited our staff to sit with a poem by Hafiz. And I just thought, this is about imagination for me. So I want to read it. Perhaps you've heard it, but I want to read it together and then just consider what you hear in this poem. The small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage who has to duck his head when the moon is low keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners. What do you hear in this poem about imagination, about possibility for church? What if our collective spirit-filled imagination creates the possibility of freedom from broken and ill-fitting paradigms or cages? What if Jesus' work on earth in his death and resurrection is the work of liberation for us and for others as he moves about telling stories, offering metaphors and images, being creative and curious, offering dreams, inviting people to live otherwise, to imagine otherwise, dropping keys of wisdom for all of us rowdy prisoners, making alternatives possible for us, inviting us to take our what-ifs and turn it into life as if that freedom existed. That's what I hear in this poem. And then when I think about this, like, notion of escaping cages, it also feels so true that imagination is not about escaping the world either, right? We might think about dreams as a way of escaping, but that imagination is actually what helps us to participate in the world better. We escape cages. We don't escape the world when we start to imagine things differently. Lola Olufemi writes that imagination is, and this is She's a poet, so this is why I think she uses these words a bit slant, but a teleological pool to draw from. I don't know if you kind of get what that is. Imagination is a teleological pool. So teleology is kind of like, what's the purpose of something? Where is it going? Where is it headed? And then based on that, we kind of define and shape what is, right? So if imagination is a whole pool of possibilities, of purpose and direction, and we choose and play with different ones that help shape and direct us in different ways. That's what imagination can do. So if I'm feeling stuck in work or stuck in a relationship, I try to imagine the purpose differently, or I try to imagine my role, reason for being in this relationship differently, and then that might help create a different path. So why do we come to church? Because I think some of us are really aching for fresh imagination. We need stories and art and conversation and play to blow these winds of creativity, beauty, dreaming through us. We want to participate in the world better. It's part of why I come here. We want the church to participate in the world better. And we want to find those keys of wisdom, right? We want to be freed from our cages, and we want to find others who want the same thing so we can work on that together. And we want to shape our imaginations to participate in the liberation work of Jesus. So let's listen to this true story, Jesus, the storyteller and prophet. And then after, we'll talk about imagination and artisan. This is Luke 4. So if roller coasters existed in Jesus' time, he might be saying at this point that he's been on a roller coaster recently. First, he's publicly baptized. A dove comes from the sky. There's a word from God saying, "This is my son with whom I'm well pleased." That happens publicly. God has sent him into the world. Then he goes to a desert where he faces temptation, and in the desert, integrating in quietness, what he's just experienced, he finds focus, resolve, clarified through testing. It's been a bit of a wild ride. But now he's really alive to his purpose, really alive to why he's here, what he's doing on earth. And so he heads back home. He heads back home to Nazareth. Nazareth is a tiny town established in the 2nd century BC, only 200 years previous. And it was established in the wake of Jerusalem being conquered. When Jerusalem was conquered, it displaced ancient Israel from that city. And so as a strategy for regaining the land, the Maccabees, who are kind of like a national militia, have set up these little enclaves in rural areas. These towns are ethnically homogenous, and as more people move into them, the hope is that the cities will grow, and over time, as people stay loyal, these become strongholds that allow them to eventually take back Jerusalem and other conquered areas. So this is Nazareth, this is his hometown, a new city established for this reason. More than that, this is in an area of Palestine that is seething with anger and fear. As just one example of many, just 20 years before Jesus was born in Nazareth, a nearby town was completely razed for perceived rebellion. Rome slaughtered everyone who lived there. It was another town like this. So imagine what sister towns have done, people like those in Nazareth, to hold in their anger at this brutality out of fear that they might end up in the same position. Or imagine the way their collective anger and hatred actually helps them hold back the fear of Rome, right? This insidious relationship between fear and hatred or anger. So this colonial enclave is where Jesus grew up. But by this point, his fame has extended far beyond Nazareth. So he stands up in the synagogue to read from the prophets. Likely there's a large group gathered to hear what he's got to say. Someone hands him the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. It's big, it's unwieldy. Actually, I don't know quite how big and unwieldy, but scrolls aren't books, right? You can't flip to the page that you want to read out of. You receive the scroll open to a specific place. And beyond the practicalities of holding and unrolling a large scroll, he's also bound by rules about how much you can skip as you read. So this moment has all the markings of a warm, celebrative homecoming and of communal imagination fulfilled. This is where he had been brought up. He went to the synagogue, as was his custom. He is handed the scroll with a predetermined passage to read where it is written. This is Isaiah 61, a real favorite in places like Nazareth. This is a big moment. This is a local boy, newly powerful. He has the potential to help us. He reads our favorite passage, helps to stoke our embers of hope. But in a moment, these same people will try to kill Jesus. So listen carefully. He reads, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me." They murmured to each other, "Yeah, remember his baptism when the Spirit came down as a dove and anointed him? That's what he's talking about. He's anointed. Anointed to do what? To proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. "We are those prisoners," they think. "We are those oppressed." But why did he stop reading there? A seed of suspicion drops. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. Those who know what he just cut out of one of their favorite passages will know Jesus is in a bit of trouble. What he says next will make or break the favor that he had just a moment ago. So he began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. Here's the anointed one, the person claiming to be the Messiah who will save his people from their subjugation. He's just cut out the best part of the prophetic promise. He's challenging their imagination for what's about to come. Where it says here in the passage that everyone was amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips, it likely actually means amazed that only gracious words came from his lips. Because what has Jesus just cut out? You can check out Isaiah 61 if you want to confirm this. He just cut out the part where God brings vengeance on their enemies. In fact, he cut a sentence in half to do it. You might say this is bad exegesis or cherry-picking the passages. "I've come to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor," but then he didn't say, "and the vengeance of our God." There's more. He actually cut out the majority of the chapter. The rest of Isaiah 61 creates a series of parallels promising a good future. It says, "You lost your land, you'll get it back. Two times as much, in fact. And you are struggling with survival. Your enemies will be forced labor for you. And you will have all the food that you need." Isaiah imagines everyone who isn't Israel serving in forced labor, imagines eating food they didn't plant or harvest, getting back their land double of what they used to. This is what Jesus cuts out. A big chunk of the beautiful future they've been imagining and kind of their reason for existing as a town. Jesus said to them, "Surely you'll quote this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal yourself.' And you will tell me, 'Do here in your hometown what we've heard that you did in Capernaum.'" Jesus knows them. He predicts what they're going to think and say. He's grown up here. This is his town. He knows this hope of what God will give them. That's their entire reason for existing. He knows that if he claims to be the anointed one, he can then be expected to bring a plan for reclaiming land, what's lost. But instead of sort of announcing the beginning of a rebellion, he's just asked them to set aside what they expect God will give them. He's asked them to reimagine themselves and now to reimagine their enemies. It actually reminds me of our place series when we heard from the Japanese Hall. I don't know if those who were here remember that. Their community was forcibly displaced from this neighborhood in the 1940s, sent to labor camps in the interior of BC. And then when they returned to this building, and the neighborhood, they decided they didn't want to return and reclaim it in a way that would displace the people that had already gathered and kind of filled in their spaces. They wanted to use this building to preserve culture and language, but then use their community resources, including space, which is a huge resource in Vancouver, right, for the good of the neighborhood. And to me, this sounds so much like Jesus in this moment, right? It's in the pain of your own displacement, don't displace other people. So verse 24, kind of paraphrasing Jesus here, he's saying, I don't expect you will receive me well in this moment, because I'm asking you to imagine otherwise, as prophets always do. And imagining otherwise isn't a romantic comedy. It's actually quite a painful thing sometimes. Then Jesus tells them two stories, spark their imagination, both in how they view themselves and how they view their enemies. So there were lots of widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years, and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. This is the widow from 1 Kings 17. She was baking bread with the last bit of food she had, and Elijah comes along and says, can I have your bread? And the widow, who's from Sidon, knows this is a prophet with access to power, but his God doesn't have any power in this jurisdiction because gods were territorial. So he can't actually help me in this moment. But she somehow finds the imagination to trust Elijah's God. And she does, and she's rewarded with survival and abundance. Story one. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. This is Naaman from 2 Kings 5. A powerful commander-in-chief of the Syrian army comes to seek healing. The prophet Elisha doesn't give him the honor he deserves, not even seeing him or letting him in, and then gives him a prescription for healing that Naaman finds quite offensive. It's kind of like, go drink a glass of water from the beach at Crab Park, and you'll feel better. And at first, he doesn't want to do it, but someone helps him find imagination for swallowing his pride and following the instructions, and then he's rewarded with health. So standing in the temple, Jesus cuts their favorite bits of prophetic hope in half. Jesus asks them to shift their imagination away from dwelling on what they expect to receive to what they're being called to do. You want to bring your fulfillment of this reading, the land, the plenty, the subjugation of enemies. But when I say this is fulfilled, I'm saying, help me proclaim freedom for the captives. Help me proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And then he points to two people who would not have been trusted by the people in the room, who were able to imagine beyond their own constraints to have faith. God's widely generous, and the time for judgment isn't being announced here. Not that there is no such thing as judgment. He doesn't say that. But he says, this is not an invitation. My arrival, the fulfillment, is not an invitation for vengeance or judgment. He asks them instead to love their enemies and maybe even find renewed imagination from their enemies. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of town, took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. But he walked right through the crowd and went away, like the sage. Dropped the key of wisdom, continues on his way, claiming the freedom that he offers. Someone I was dialoguing with via email this week summarized my reading of this story in this way. I thought it was helpful. Imagination can be a risky business that threatens our settled convictions. We tend to be formed inside certain kinds of stories that keep telling us we have a certainty about the right way. But this parochial certainty makes all of us in our communities blind, and sometimes even in opposition to the larger story of God's teleology or purpose or end goal. I wonder what invitation you hear in this story for us, for yourself. Maybe there's a question about your favorite theological bits, the bits that help to justify, reassure you you're on the right side. How can we turn that lens back to ourselves, not just on others? The pieces that we might need to have liberated by Jesus. When I first met the lead team of Artisan, this is a couple years ago now, I asked them, we were at Honeybee Brunchnet, And I asked them, what's your desire for Artisan? I just kind of wanted to have a sense of like what people in this community are wanting. Is this something that I want to join in with? And one of them said, I long for us to face the grief of not being able to make our own satisfaction and meaning of life. Even with all the privileges, wealth, and beauty of Vancouver, our individual imaginations are inadequate. Perhaps we need a kind of collective death that returns Jesus to our midst. I think we after we had that brunch, we went up on the hill. I was like, I would like to join you. Let's do that. So, why is imagination important for this community at this point in time, in this place? I mean, in some ways it feels obvious, but also I think that where our collective imagination needs refreshing, also there are individual parts of our imagination that need refreshing. And so it's going to be as many as the number of people in this room. I hear people saying they want to renew imagination for what the church even is. I hear people say they want to be able to imagine a good and meaningful life in this place. I hear people say they need hope that the world isn't just going to hell in a handbasket, maybe not using that language, that's mine. That we need imagination to sustain our hope and fuel our work in the world. We don't sometimes have a lot of that. There's a book called Beauty is Oxygen, and in it, the author says, in a time of racialized violence, environmental crisis, and growing inequalities, the beauty of the arts and creation can bear witness to a weighty, anchored hope, one that does not evade the reality of evil and injustice. Beauty sustains our hope and therefore the belief that our labor, everything from earth tending to art making, is not in vain. I think we have to imagine a possibility before we can enact it, and we need one another to hold us accountable to that work. We long for a beautiful teleology where we have a powerful what if, and together we kind of live as if, right, together. Two things, though, before I get into practicalities, and that's just like how we imagine matters. And to what end we imagine really matters. So I want to offer to what end we imagine. Just two things. First thing, and I just feel this so strongly this week that I might get a little weepy. We don't imagine, and this is why I really appreciate Tim's music choice this morning. We don't imagine in order to participate in culture or ideological wars. We don't imagine in order to participate in culture wars. We imagine because we want to break something open in ourselves, right? And we want to imagine so that we can participate in a better way in the world. We don't, at Artisan, we don't reimagine faith or refresh faith because we think we're different from or better than any other group of Christ followers. We imagine because we want to break open something in ourselves, and this is where it's happening for us. This is not about people who like Artisan's theology or don't like it. It's not about being on the right side of history or the wrong side of history. It's not about creating a binary between tradition and creativity or orthodoxy and justice. When we live into those binaries, I really think we tear apart the beautiful possibilities in the body of Christ. And so I think refreshing our imagination for church, for scripture, for prayer, for faith, for engagement with culture, I think that what that is about, in my humble opinion, is about breaking something open inside of ourselves. It's our longing to break open and come alive to the reality of our anger, sadness, and joy. And to find others who want the Spirit to break into this world, break into our midst, break through our patterns of making and breaking. And part of that means that we have to practice. We have to practice it. I was rereading a bit of Willie J. Jennings' Christian Imagination this week, and he writes about deacons. In his introduction, there were deacons from a nearby white Christian Reformed church, and they came to visit him and his mom, and they just assumed that they weren't Christians. I started evangelizing them. They were leaders in their own church. He says these people lacked imagination. They had a racially distorted imagination that didn't imagine them to be Christian, right? And he says part of that is that they were detached from their surroundings, both in terms of people and place. They just weren't in touch with it. But then he turns the sort of critique back on his own community. He talks about his own community of young Black Christians, I think it's in the 60s. He says, we were poised to imagine our belonging in ways that were unanticipated by our parents and grandparents. It was a moment of imagination, right? Parents and grandparents who had fled the hateful South, but those imaginative possibilities desperately needed guidance. They needed theological voices that would have drawn us beyond ideologies. And then Jennings goes on to critique a sort of anemic theology where we don't want to think theologically about our identities and our lives. We want to have like our imagination tickled, you know, on a Sunday, and then we want to go back to our regular lives. So bringing those things together to say, we want to encounter the good news of Jesus, and then we want to do the hard work of imagining what that looks like in concrete terms. We've got these stories from this storyteller. We're story keepers. But to be responsible to those stories, to the beautiful possibilities of Jesus' way or the Creator's world, we have to do this like what if together and then live as if. We got to bring the two together. Not separating imagination from practice, not allowing our imagination to become captive to the culture wars that we find ourselves in the middle of. So how does it change us then? I think if we follow the way of Jesus, we are, I like the idea of making do, making better with the random assortment of things and resources in front of us. Someone mentioned kids earlier. Kids are, they have great imaginations, in part because they haven't lived long in reality. So once you've lived a few decades, you've got a pretty good idea of what's possible and what is no longer possible. I think most women in their 40s at some point have said to one another, oh, we aren't going to be going to the Olympics, are we? That dream is dead. So it's good and wise to focus your attention on what's possible, what's, you know, where you're going to be most effective. But across a lifetime, these bigger dreams, these bigger possibilities close down. And I think what happens is we also start to underestimate the possibilities for creativity within the smallness of what is, right? We forget that imagination also can take and make do with very little to make something big. Our lives feel determined. We want to adjust our dreams to fit. Maybe the Spirit's imagination needs to kick back in, show us what we can do with our small lives. I received a gift this week that did that for me. Actually, it was last week after the church service gathering. Russell brought me a gift. He teaches art, and the gift he gave me was an old art project called Cracked Ceilings. I'll probably bring it out next Sunday at the Screen-Free Sunday. And he said in a card that he was offering me this in exchange for the words that I offer on Sunday. And his way of putting that sparked something in me that was much bigger than that small exchange. It made me curious if we could reimagine church in this way. In a moment when we feel like we've lost a bit of broader relevance, maybe one of the things we do is we create space for the Spirit to inspire these exchanges of beauty in our rituals, music, words, space, ideas, art. And when I mentioned this to Russell in a follow-up email, he then sent me a brilliant paragraph full of questions about rituals that I don't have time to go into. And I thought, okay, that needs to be another sermon series at some point. But this email is exactly why I'm here in the church, because of these exchanges. I want to scrabble around in the dirt with other people looking for those keys, right? Seeing what we make of what's right in front of us. And church can be this sacred space of creative imagination shaped by the Spirit, where we hold each other accountable to a larger imagination. It might be a complex path that requires principled embrace, and it might be a roller coaster sort of path where old paradigms drop away and we find ourselves free-falling, but we do it together. Okay. Where where imagination comes out in Artisan, all over the place. I'm just gonna say two places, just for the sake of time. So I'm gonna offer two places, two ways to move into this work of collective imagination. And it happens all the time behind the scenes, right? This summer, a group of songwriters went away and wrote songs for us. And I think one of them will be sung next week, and one of them was sung last week. So we're already, you know, benefiting from one another's imagination. But it's not just the artists, it's all of us. So one of the ways I think I see us doing this is there's a couple of times a year where we have like what we call family meeting or family dialogue, where we get together and we talk about something of importance to us. And last year, or in the spring, it was on how to have difficult conversations, right? That's us imagining how to be peacemakers in the world. That takes work, and we need to learn the skills. So actually, next spring, we're likely going to do a four-part series where we dig into that a little bit more deeply, concretely. What are the skills that help us with difficult conversations? So family dialogues, that's one of the places apart from this gathering where we do this imaginative work. There's also, there's also the church calendar, there's weekly liturgies, there's so many places. It's one of the things that I love about church is the way imagination comes out in these really creative ways. But let me just offer one other thing as a way of closing. For those of you who are in a current phase of faith deconstruction, or maybe have that as a recent part of your history, I wonder if we can reimagine deconstruction together. I wonder if deconstruction, I mean, in my mind, deconstruction feels very mechanical, feels very alienating as a word, as a metaphor. And I wonder if we could instead imagine that the shifts and the transformation that happen in your theologies and practices of faith are actually growth. Can we imagine them as old skins being shed? Can we imagine them as the pains of birth? Maybe this is even what it happens when Jesus gives keys to rowdy prisoners. So I want to say to you, if this is where you're at, I know not all of us are, but if this is where you're at, I would love to say with all gentleness, this isn't your deconstruction, this is your rebirth. And I do hope also that our imagination coming alive to the possibilities that exist beyond human paradigms broken by sin. So if you'll pray with me, we'll close there and then we'll come to the table together. Creator God, give us wisdom to imagine with what you've given us in this good world. Please give us the courage to imagine otherwise, to live as if the inbreaking of your kingdom is a reality. And give us the persistence and boldness to embrace those we see as enemies, to try to imagine and dream and play and create beyond the rigidities of cultural wars or ideological boundaries. May our imaginations just be steeped in the work of your Spirit, the stories of Jesus, and in these good books that we've been given. Amen.